Welcome to Monday's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We hope you had a great Independence Day weekend. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, Dr. Tom Easern from North Dakota State University in his Plainsfolk essay presents a new biography that may change the way you think about the Marquise de Moore, the founder of Medora. Plus, one of North Dakota's own, longtime Secret Service agent Clint Hill, will be honored with a memorial in the beginning of August. That will happen in Washburn, and we'll bring you that story. And we begin Main Street today with the story of Kyle Myers, who at age 14 learned he had multiple sclerosis. In the United States, nearly 1 million adults are living with MS. A diagnosis of multiple sclerosis can change the course of life in an instant. For Kyle Myers, it came when he was just 14 years old, along with predictions that his athletic career was over. But rather than accepting those limits, Myers found new ways to compete, to lead, and to grow. He went on to play college football, coach at the University of North Dakota, build a career in athletics administration, and now has written a book called Beating MS, Lessons in Resilience, Reinvention, and Leadership. It's a story much more about living with a chronic illness. It's about resilience, adapting to change, and finding purpose when life doesn't go according to plan. Kyle, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Kyle, take us back to the moment when you were 14 years old and you learned that you had MS.
Sure, yeah. Well, being so young and having no clue what the disease was and what it meant and things like that, it was a pretty interesting time in my life at that age where, you know, as a young person trying to figure out who I am as well as who I'm going to be, you know, to learn some news that kind of fractures the direction I thought I was going. That was hard for me at that age, as well as for my parents, who also didn't know much about the disease. So, you know, there was obviously a handful of challenges that we were met with and had no idea the direction we were going. And 25 years later, here we are.
What symptoms did you have, Kyle, that made you or your folks think something may be off here?
Well, at that time, I was a baseball player. Baseball was a sport that my parents told me I was going to play in the major league, and then that was the sport that I seemed to be passionate about and excel in at a young age. So the symptoms that I dealt with, it actually began as optic neuritis. Optic neuritis is a condition that many people hear and learn about preceding a diagnosis with multiple sclerosis. So that was kind of the direction things went. It actually started on the baseball field. I was having some migraines before I got into the baseball field for the incident that I'm going to tell you about here. But a little sluggish. I was getting lethargic. And as a young athletic kid, I was a younger brother of another athlete. And he was a little bit of a bully on me at times as a little brother. But, you know, I had a lot of opportunities where I was able to show my parents my energy level and how I was feeling with things. And they noticed sometimes that I was no longer the upbeat kid that I usually was, arguing and fighting with my brother around the house. But there was specifically a baseball game. I played first base. I was with an AAU team. I had a really good third baseman, Kelly Cannon, for an arm over there. He threw me a ball on it. He played a ground ball, and he threw it over to me at first base, and I completely missed the ball. And the ball hit me square in my chest. The most interesting part was I was waiting for the ball to hit my glove. It was a very routine play. It was easy as playing catch in the backyard, but I didn't touch the ball. The ball went right past my glove and it hit me in my chest. It was an awkward enough play and an uncharacteristic enough play where a lot of folks recognized that something very strange just happened. That proceeded to me getting pulled off the field by the coaches. And then my parents pulled me out of the diamond, and then we headed on to a whole lot of doctor visits and specialist visits, and it kind of proceeded from there. So, in a long way to answer that question, it started on the baseball field. I missed a play that I should have made, and that got the ball rolling down the hill that I wish it wasn't rolling down back then.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your treatment, at least initially, for MS, and what has changed, Kyle, with your treatment over the years?
Well, I can tell you, I mentioned before, 25 years, I've been I was diagnosed 25 years ago, and over the time, a lot has changed with the medications and things like that and treatments. For me, initially, we went directly into what's called Solumedrol, and that's an infusion. So I had to get hooked up at home. It was an in-home treatment, but I had an IV in my arm that lasted about a week long. And the idea is that Solumedrol, in layman's terms, it kind of sucks the bad stuff out fairly quickly. And most people regain all the control and a lot of the symptoms. They regain majority of the things that they, the way they were feeling and how they were doing prior to whichever incident led a person to that, needing that treatment. For me, I got that treatment and it did what the doctor said it would. I went from feeling lethargic to optic neuritis, which causes blurred vision. It caused some redness in my vision. And that almost kind of triggers a handful of other things for me, at least it did. So for me, when I was at that young age, I knew that if I started having some red in my vision and blurred vision, that there were some other steps I would want to follow. So learning through those symptoms and things like that were tough. But the Solumedrol did clean up a lot of the issues I was having, and it cleaned it up enough in July to August that by the end of August into September, my doctors, although I was newly diagnosed, they gave me the green light to go ahead and try to play football, which sounded very ironic to the coaches who saw baseball slipping away from me that I was excited to go try and play football. So that was the direction that it sent me from there.
Was it harder for you with MS to play the sport, Kyle, or did you feel normal?
I don't want to say it was harder, because obviously I played sports, and not to be arrogant about it, I played sports at a high level. Sports was very important to me. There was always something on the line. I had a lot of competitive teammates and things like that. And I'm sure that they worked very hard and sacrificed a lot, just like I did. But to answer your question, I would say, yes, it was harder for me. And one of the reasons that made it hard was that no one can see how I felt. No one could see that I had image issues. No one could see that I had extreme fatigue, and that's why I wasn't able to move as fast as maybe they thought I should be, or moving as fast as they've seen me move before, and they can't understand why I'm not moving that fast. So a lot in those cases, from the coach's perspective as well as the teammate's perspective, it could look like Kyle is not playing as hard as he should be, or playing as hard as his teammates are. So that can create a dynamic that can be extremely frustrating for a young teenager in an athletic environment who is still trying to be as competitive as possible. Meanwhile, the skill level and the ability is kind of sliding due to some of those symptoms that impacted my play. Baseball is a great example of that. Obviously, if you have trouble with your vision, and for me, that trouble I had, my vision was caused by optic neuritis and multiple sclerosis. Baseball faded away. And my skills and my talent levels, it also kind of went away. So that was a very challenging thing that I had to deal with. And then on the other side, moving on into a football world, that side of it got worse. Because again, your teammates can't see what you're going through. But they know that they ran the sprints just like I ran the sprints, and they sacrificed all the things that I did. And they expected me to be able to perform at a level as high as they did. And when I couldn't, it was a very challenging scenario for me to try to explain to my teammates and to my coaches on why I wasn't giving out the output that they perceived that everyone else was.
What is multiple sclerosis, Kyle?
Multiple sclerosis is a tricky disease. It's a disease that can mean something for everyone, mean something different for everyone who has it. Some folks with MS really, really struggle. Some folks, it can debilitate them and break down their body in a lot of different ways. The disease actually deals with the coating that protects your nerves, the myelin that protects your nerves. Those things can corrode and kind of cause issues. For me personally, MS began with lesions and white spots and plaque and things like that on my brain scans. For me, MS means a lot of MRIs. A lot of checkups with neurologists and doctors and things like that. But for me personally, MS MS meant perseverance. It meant making the most of the opportunities that I still had. It meant learning a new way to view things and a new way to approach scenarios and situations from a different perspective. Multiple sclerosis for me became something that taught me to make the most of all the opportunities that I had and that I might be able to have. So for me, multiple sclerosis is a lifestyle adjustment, and it can be very threatening, but it can also be a thing that sends a certain person down a path that perhaps they didn't see them going down. But you look up 25 years later and you realize that you accomplished many of the things that you were told you weren't going to be able to do and that you shouldn't try. And again, I want to go back to saying that that's probably not the case for many other people with the disease. I'm very, very fortunate that that is what MS means to me, because for some folks, they have a less fortunate scenario and a less fortunate experience with the disease. So in my long way of explaining the definition, I hope I could at least throw some things in there that could help someone learn a little bit more about the disease. But I also hope folks know that the disease does not mean an ending. And in many cases, for those people who are able to figure out ways to make the most of what they still have, it's typically the start of something new, the start of a challenging, an adverse chapter in their lives. But it could be a chapter that becomes the best part of the story.
Enjoy my conversation with Kyle Myers. He's written a new book called Beating MS, Lessons in Resilience, Reinvention, and Leadership. He went on to play college football, even though he was diagnosed with the disease when he was just 14 years old. He's also coached at the University of North Dakota, and he's built a career in athletics administration. Kyle, why did you choose to write a book?
When I was first diagnosed with the disease, I was told a lot about the things that I wouldn't be able to do, that the symptoms would cause me to have problems with this thing, with energy level, with vision, that the disease would cause my body to shut down, that the temperature and the heat when I was out trying to play football, things like that, I was told that my body wouldn't hold up. And trying to compete and play sports and be active and then still try to be out there with friends and trying to be a kid that I was at that time and just trying to make the most of different scenarios, I was told that those things were going to be different. After I realized that I accomplished many of the things that I was told that I shouldn't try, I felt like there was a story in there that somebody should need. My parents and I, we went through a lot of research. We did a lot of research when I was first diagnosed. Not so much me. I was a kid. My parents did. My parents did most of the research trying to learn about the disease. And what we continued to learn was that there was a lot of negative information. Negative in terms of, I don't want to say negative, factual-based scientific information out there that said the data says this, the data shows this. A lot of those data points showed that a person like me probably should stop playing sports and should sit down and not be as active. Once I realized that I was able to continue doing the things that I was doing, after a few fallbacks and after a few relapses and things like that, I had to work through, I realized that I was actually able to accomplish a lot more than what I was told I was going to be able to, and that my story somewhat became the kind of story that I wish I came across when I was first diagnosed. Mm. I felt like I kind of had a little bit of a story of hope. We could go find several pieces of literature telling us how our the negative things that occur to us in life. In my case, a disease. In someone else's case, it could be something different. A lot of those things tell us what's going to happen. But the piece that's usually missing in those scenarios is the courage. And just by relying on that, I think you can kind of accomplish a lot more. And by sharing my story, I'm hoping that people could see that if they can just obviously first get the approval of a medical profession, but if you can just push on some of those things that may be some kind of perceived resistance that we shouldn't try, if we're able to push those limits and extend our comfort level just a little bit, we might be able to accomplish more than what we originally thought. I think that my story could share that with others and hopefully inspire them in ways that I wish I was inspired when I was a young person and I was first diagnosed.
Well, it's amazing that you focus on what you can do, I think, instead of what you can't. But I have to, I guess, realize you still have at times setbacks or relapses. How do you maintain your enthusiasm for what you do? How do you do it?
In the book, the end of the book, which in real life, this occurred in 2024. In 2024, I was fortunate enough for the University of North Dakota sent me to represent athletics at an event in Los Angeles. And this is kind of, hopefully I don't give it away too much, but somewhat of a closing scene of the book. I was able to have an experience at a place called Point at the Bluffs in the Pacific Palisades in Los Angeles. And it was, I think I saw it on a TikTok video or something before I went. When I got there, it was such a beautiful view, I needed to go experience it. So I did. And while I was there, I had a conversation with a stranger. And we talked for a while, and we kind of discussed how circumstances in life can lead us a different direction than we planned, and strange things happen. That stranger was someone from a different part of the country, me being from New Jersey. We connected on that while looking at the view that we had there. In Los Angeles, and she said something that I felt like has kind of been one of the things that have inspired me my whole life. She said that she reached that point in her life simply by doing the best she can with what she had, wherever she was. I've learned more. That's a little bit more of a cliche thing than I was aware of at the time, but it immediately struck a bell for me. That's what this has been for me. That's what I feel like it is for a lot of us. Our mission should be, to some extent, to always be trying to maximize the experiences we have. So to do the best I can with what I have, wherever I am, that's become a philosophy for me that I try to live by. So when I do have them relapses and I do have those hard times, the output doesn't change in terms of me doing the best I can. There's no 110%. I don't owe that output to anyone. I don't owe 105%. I give 100%. That's me doing the best I can with whatever I have and making the most of it. I have a way of trying to stay on the positive side of things. I see the glass is half full. So kind of training the mind over the past 25 years to see things from that perspective, to try to lean towards sharing goodness as opposed to anything else with people. That has helped me stay on the positive side of things and hopefully share and spread some of that positivity with others. And that's been something that's kind of helped me stay on the positive end, even when I do experience those relapses. You can't run from them. They're going to happen. I'm fortunate enough that I don't deal with as many relapses as many other people do. And I try to celebrate that in my own way. But in any case, that I know that can change for me. I've been fortunate to do well for a long time. I haven't had a severe relapse in a long time. And I'm thankful for that. But I do understand that could be out there. And when that comes, I intend to approach it the same way as trying to keep the glass half full. Simply doing the best I can with what I have, where I am today.
What's your prognosis, Kyle? What have your physicians told you about, you know what, in 5 years, in 10 years, in 15 years, have you looked ahead or do you live day to day?
I absolutely live day to day. And that goes into, for me, doing the best I can with what I have, where I am. Well, where I am is today. I try not to look too far ahead, keeping in mind that we have no other direction to go. Obviously, we're moving forward and tomorrow is important, but we're going to make sure we make the most of the opportunities and the good health that we have today, as well as the loved ones that we can just share this day with.
His book is called Beating MS, Lessons in Resilience, Reinvention, and Leadership, visiting with Kyle Myers. Kyle, writing this book, has it changed at all the way you have now framed your journey or your relationship with MS?
Yes, in some ways. Obviously, a lot of opportunity to reflect. And reflect on how this decision occurred this to happen. Me being from New Jersey and me not growing up around golf, golf is not a sport that I grew up playing or that was in my family. My dad didn't play a lot of golf growing up or anything like that. So the fact that I've ended up in the position that I am, it's kind of an interesting part to the story, and it goes back to the ripple effects that occurred throughout my life. And when I say the beating MS part of the title of the book deals with the ripple effects that were created by that diagnosis and the adjustments that I had to make and how I had to live. Some of those things and opportunities sent me down a path that had some bumps in it. It had some forks in the road, and I chose this way instead of that way. Writing the book helped me see some of those things, some of those directions and things that I've made and look back and kind of put them into words, and also try to find the real spots where the real motivation came from, as well as the people that were maybe, the unsung heroes of scenarios, the people who I didn't really realize maybe supported me in ways that I underestimated at that time as a young athlete. When my parents were willing to send me out there knowing that I might fail, but they were still willing to send me out there to encourage me to trust my body and to give it all I can, all that I've got. Writing the book helped me consider and realize some of those things. And it wasn't just parents, it was coaches. It was great teammates that I had along the way, mentors. I ended up managing a golf course, like I said, not because of my handicap. I didn't know what a handicap was when I gained this position. So being able to look back and understand that this wasn't I didn't beat MS by myself. I was able to beat it by relying on support, people who had love for me, people who wanted to see me do well, and who were willing to contribute to the direction where I was going. Writing the book helped me see and realize those things, and it also helped me realize that I might have some things to offer some folks who might be looking for inspiration from a certain perspective. I could talk about all the negative things. We all have our pains and the hardships that we go through fighting the disease and many other diseases as well. But I decided to take a different side of it, and to try to attack things. And by doing that, hopefully I created a story that others hopefully want to read and be a part of, and hopefully can utilize in their lives and share the information with others. And hopefully we can try to improve some things that we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Where can we find the book, Kyle?
It looks like Barnes & Noble has it available now. Any resource where you can find books, you'll be able to find it. But Amazon is somewhat of the home place for it. That is where a person could find they could find the ebook version. It is in various formats. You can find the paperback as well as the hardcover. And the audio book will also be there as soon as possible. So I hope that people would go to Amazon, but I also hope you can find it in your local bookstores as well. And if it's not there, tell
me
to get it.
Well, Kyle, we certainly wish you the best. Kyle's the author of Beating MS, Lessons in Resilience, Reinvention, and Leadership. Kyle, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Support for PrayPublic is provided by Planned Parenthood, offering health education for teens and workshops for parents on topics including health, relationships, and growing up. More at ppncs.org.
Still to come on Main Street, the community of Washburn is honoring longtime Secret Service agent Clint Hill. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Clint Hill's split-second decision to shield First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy during the assassination of President John F. Kennedy became one of the defining images of American history. But to the people of Washburn, North Dakota, Hill was more than a Secret Service hero. He was a hometown son who never forgot where he came from. John Schulz is the chairman of the Clint Hill Memorial Committee, and he joins us to discuss a new memorial honoring Hill's extraordinary life of service, courage, humility, and enduring connection to North Dakota. John, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig.
Before we talk about the memorial itself, John, tell us about Clint Hill. What made him such an important figure, not just nationally, but here in North Dakota?
Well, Clint Hill, as you mentioned, was raised in Washburn, North Dakota. And the person he became in the Secret Service and later in life was certainly formed by his being raised in Washburn, North Dakota. He, of course, his claim to fame, infamous claim to fame, was when he climbed on the back of that limousine in Dallas, Texas, to shield Mrs. Kennedy when JFK was killed. But he went on to serve five different presidents in the Secret Service detail. And in that time period, he also was the Secret Service agent assigned exclusively to Jacqueline Kennedy. Clint Hill retired from the Secret Service because of problems that he had with PTSD from the event in Dallas when he was 43. And he did quite a bit of consulting work and all of that. And later in life, then he met Lisa McCubbin, who became his wife, and they together created 5 books of his life and legacy working in the Secret Service and other aspects of life. He was a very intelligent man, very, very gentle, very caring person. And when he did return back to North Dakota, of course, the most notable time was when he received the Rough Rider Award from Governor Burgum in 2018. He requested that this award be given to him in Washburn, his hometown. And there were many people in the audience. He asked their last name, and he would absolutely know their parents' first name. So he had quite a memory and of good times in Washburn.
How do people in Washburn remember him beyond that single act of heroism and the Rough Rider Award that you just spoke of? Tell us what people remember about Clint.
Well, in my generation, we're one generation past his people that mostly recall him in Washburn. Say the age of my parents, if they were still living, would kind of be in that time when they knew him. He was quite an athlete, in my understanding. He excelled in all sports, and he carried that on when he went to Concordia College to get his degree in business. But I have a story to tell about my wife, who her parents owned a store in Washburn called Holton Mercantile. Her father, Orville, worked in the hardware section, and he gave Clint his first job when he was 15 years old for delivering materials that people had purchased at that hardware store throughout the community of Washburn, and he was paid 18.5 cents an hour. So that gives you some time, you know, when he was there. He graduated from high school there in 1950.
Enjoying my conversation with John Scholes. He's the vice commander of the Victor B. Wallen American Legion Post 12 and chairman of the Clint Hill Memorial Committee. John, how did the idea of creating a permanent memorial for Clint Hill begin?
Well, this has been in the works for probably 5 or 6 years. And it was the brainchild of two individuals that are in the Legion, Terry Dworshak and Newell Zeller. And at last year's Memorial Day services in Washburn, which we have 300-400 people going every year, and this year happened to be the 143rd Memorial Day service in our Legion unit, the Victor B. Wallen Legion unit. So anyway, at this Memorial Day service last year, Terry Dworshak asked me if I would consider being chairman of this Clint Hill Memorial Committee. And I looked at him and I said, it would be an honor. So it's been out there for a while. They just couldn't find anybody who would take the work and carry it through. So
why is it important to build something lasting rather than just simply having a ceremony after his passing?
Well, very much. And the monument itself, if I may, is a granite piece, 6 feet high, 5 feet wide, 3 feet deep, and black in color. And there's a flag draped on one side, which really looks good. I've seen some of the renderings already. And on the front side, we'll have a picture of Clint Hill, his name, of course, his birth and death date. Right under that, we'll have Washburn's native son. And then we'll have a large brass plaque that will have that infamous picture of him climbing on the back of the limousine. And below that, discussing some of the particulars of that day. And below that, we'll have one of his famous quotes when he received the 2018 Rough Rider Award. "I've never emotionally left North Dakota. North Dakota has a very special place in my heart that will never go away." And that's one quote that his widow, Lisa McCubbin Hill, wanted to see on that monument, and one that she feels is so, so moving. Then on the back of the monument, we'll have 5 brass plaques that will depict other situations in his life. There'll be one that's called North Dakota Roots, Military and Secret Service Career, Publications, Honors, and Legacy. They'll touch on his working under 5 presidents, and then one on his later life, what he what he was doing, and most of that will be talking about. He was an author and traveling around the country quite a bit and speaking about his experiences.
John, I understand there'll be stone benches around the monument. What was the thinking behind creating a place where people can not just view, but maybe sit and reflect?
Well, absolutely. There'll be two benches at an angle out front, and they're fairly large. And, yeah, just to sit and contemplate his life and read what is on the front and the back of the monument. The bench that is in the back has a back to it, and on that back we will have inscribed major donors, and of course the people who thought of the Clint Hill Memorial first, Terry Dworshak and Newell Zeller. They'll be honored there, and so that'll give some local flavor to it. And there's room for additions as we go down, you know, in the future.
What's an important part of his story that we should remember today as maybe we sit and reflect about his life, not just the emotional trauma that he experienced on November 22nd, 1963? What do you hope people think about when they consider this memorial?
His unwavering public service, dedication to the helping individuals, those that he was assigned to help, and just very, very, very intelligent man, very personable, and just a nice person to be around. I think those are some of his best attributes.
Walk us through what people can expect when Dedication Day comes on August 1st.
The dedication is August 1st, 2026, as you mentioned, and it is a combined effort of the Victor B. Wallen Post 12 and the City of Washburn. Now, it's going to be held at Veterans Memorial Park in downtown Washburn. The program starts at 2:30, patriotic musical selections by the 188th Army Band, 37 musicians. And then after the band, the actual dedication ceremony begins at 3 p.m. And as a vice commander and in charge of the Clint Hill Project and the MC, and we'll have a few comments to begin, and then we'll have presentation of the colors by the Washburn American Legion and the American Legion Auxiliary. The 188th Army Band will play the national anthem. Then we have a local soloist, April Facer, who will be singing America the Beautiful. And then the final three verses, and we have this on the reverse side of the program, we ask those in attendance to sing along. Following that, we'll have welcome and remarks by our current commander, Daryl Metzger, followed by welcome remarks by Washburn Mayor Mark Lelm. And then I'll introduce the special guests, Lisa McCubbin Hill and her family. And we have, at last count, over 30 Hill families coming from North Dakota and surrounding states. And it's been a pleasure to talk to all these people. And they'll probably have a family reunion associated with this, but that's really nice, and I'm really happy that they're attending. Following that, we anticipate having Senator John Hovind with us to provide comments, and then I have written remarks from Congresswoman Julie Federchak and Governor Kelly Armstrong that I'll be reading, as well as remarks from the United States Secret Service Association. Following that, then the final speaker will be Lisa McCubbin Hill, and that should be very interesting. She'll cover a lot of their book writing, their personal lives, their travels, and all this, capturing perhaps the last 10 years of his life. Then we'll have the 188th Army Band playing God Bless America as Lisa and the Hill family move towards the monument. The monument will be covered. And following that band number, she will unveil the monument. Closing comments, and following that, we have a catered dinner at the Washburn Memorial Hall with entertainment from Joe Wigand, who portrays Theodore Roosevelt in Medora, and we'll also have a musical selection by the Washburn Community Choir. That will pretty much take care of the day. So we look forward to a really uplifting, honorable, just a good day to remember Clint Hill and honor this man.
My guest is John Schultz. He's the vice commander of Victor B. Wallen American Legion Post 12 and chairman of the Clint Hill Memorial Committee. Events happen on August 1st, as John just described. John, what does this day mean for Washburn?
Big day. Big day, because a lot of people grasp who this man was and where he came from. A lot of people still live in this community that knew of him, probably not didn't know him face to face because they're much younger. But the Washburn community is looking forward to having additional people visit this site in ensuing years. And taking that, I am after the dedication, and I'm going to be working with a company to develop brochures about the Clint Hill Memorial and hopefully share those with the Lewis and Clark building that's in Washburn and also Department of Tourism. And I think Washburn is interested in potential people coming to the community to see this. And, of course, then they will spend a little time perhaps and utilize businesses that are there. So that's one aspect of it. But I think the first thing is that they know who this man was. And they want to spend time at this dedication to honor him.
What do you hope a child visiting the memorial 50 years from now takes away from Clint Hill's story? There's so much history that isn't maybe remembered by kids today in school. What do you hope that this memorial will mean to someone, even a little person, 50 years from now?
Well, we hope that they take a look at it and grasp what happened that particular day. Look at the back of the monument and see what this man was involved with in his life just on the surface. And on their own interest, research it. If it's a young child from Washburn, well, they already have a buy-in because this man was raised in Washburn. And there's always that association with some place that you call hometown. And I guess that's what I would like to see, that they would read this and then pursue more information on this man and get to know him, what kind of person he was.
John, is there a place online where we can learn more about what you have planned for August 1st?
Put it on Facebook, a number of places. And we also have a lot of public relations written materials coming out now in some of the newspapers, some of the advertising areas in McLean County and beyond. And that is probably it. And there are local flyers being placed in quite a few businesses in Bismarck and Washburn for sure, and some other communities in the state.
Well, John, thank you so much for taking this project on and for sharing not only the story about the memorial, but the story of Clint Hill. It's one that's embedded in our national history and one that we can remember now forever in Washburn. The Clint Hill Memorial dedication takes place on Saturday, August 1st. At Veterans Memorial Park in downtown Washburn. Ceremony, as John said, will feature the 188th Army Band, patriotic music, remarks from state and national leaders, and Clint Hill's widow, Lisa McCubbin Hill. Then a community dinner will follow at the Washburn Memorial Hall. For many Americans, Clint Hill will forever be remembered for one extraordinary act of courage, but for North Dakotans, he also stands as an example of humility, service, and a lifelong love for home. And I think, John, that the new memorial ensures that legacy will endure for generations to come. Thank you so much for joining us today on Main Street.
And thank you, Peg. And just one more comment. No, there are no RSVPs needed for this event. Everyone is welcome to come and celebrate him on this day. So I'd like to see as many people as possible. We're planning for close to 300 to 400 people right now. So be fun.
Best wishes. Thank you, John.
Thank you so much.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Hidden Brain. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public. This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. The Marquise de Morris has long been remembered in North Dakota as the colorful founder of Medora, a cattle baron, duelist, and ambitious dreamer whose fortunes rose and fell in the Badlands. But a provocative new book argues there's a much darker side to his story. In this edition of Plainsfolk, Dr. Tom Easern examines historians Sergio Lizzuto's biography, The First Fascist, which portrays Morez as an early architect of the anti-Semitic and authoritarian ideas that would later fuel fascism in Europe. It's a reminder that history is often more complicated and more unsettling than the legends we inherit.
A powerful new biography of Antoine Amédée Marie Vincent Banca Amat de la Vallombrosa, here generally known as the Marquis de Morez, has consequence on both sides of the Atlantic, in France and in Dakota Territory. Its author is Sergio Lizzuto, an Italian historian with a named professorship at the University of Connecticut. Its title is The First Fascist, The Sensational Life and Dark Legacy of the Marquis de Morez, publisher Harvard University Press. In the prologue, Lizzuto invokes a youthful Hannah Arendt, pondering in 1941 the origins of fascism, suspecting there was something significant about the infamous Dreyfus Affair, which drove a Jewish officer out of the French army in the 1890s. She sought the point of origin of fascism, not in Italy or in Germany, but in France. Lizzuto returns to this question with receipts. The Marquis, we'll just call him that for now, recognizing his title as an expatriate Sardinian brought up in France, going forth from his boyhood in Cannes, had a dissolute youth, Jesuit military schooling ornamented with profligate spending, casinos, and bordellos. Importantly, Lizzuto chronicles the Marquis's early habits of violent anti-Semitism, leading student mobs in physical violence against Jewish businessmen. Morez was handsome and a good talker, and somehow won the hand of the American banking heiress, Medora von Hoffman, which marriage financed the next stage of his life in the Badlands of Dakota Territory. There, Morez, in the 1880s, sought not just to engage in the livestock business, but to enact a fantastic scheme to defy the major packers, slaughter beef at multiple Western sites, and make a fortune, while establishing a sort of feudal lordship over the community of Medora. His only success was beating a murder rap for the killing of the buffalo hunter, Riley Lefsey. Theodore Roosevelt famously came away from the Badlands with impulses that animated his progressive public life. Morez, Lizzuto tells us, came away with the conviction that disorder would produce a new order and that the most fundamental law was the survival of the fittest. Morez acted upon such convictions on return to France, following another feckless venture in French Indochina, the failure of which he blamed on others. Still operating on his father-in-law's cash, he emerged in the 1890s, alongside Edward Drummond, as the leading agitator of pseudo-populist anti-Semitism. The Marquis de Morez, says Lizzuto, wanted to make himself the most recognizable and foul-mouthed interpreter of this rising resentment. In an amazing stroke of irony, he organized the butchers of Paris into street mobs to terrorize his enemies and shout, "Death to the Jews." He also organized reserve army officers to bait Jewish military men into duels and kill them, which he himself did, killing Armand Meyer, who was handicapped by an injury to his sword arm, on the 23rd of June, 1892, and once again beating a homicide rap. The friends of Riley Lefsey would like a word, please. Dr. Arendt, perhaps you'd like to join the discussion. Eventually, Morez ran out his stock and his cash and embarked on another half-baked enterprise, seeking to draw desert peoples of North Africa into an anti-Jewish and anti-British Franco-Arab alliance. Somebody, probably his Tuareg guides, killed him in the Sahara. And somehow, after all this, he was remembered as a visionary and an adventurer rather than a failure and a fascist. We have a problem. North Dakota is more than complicit has been a willing partner in this failure of historical acuity. We need to think about this.
Dr. Tom Mizrin is a University Distinguished Professor of History at North Dakota State University and a longtime contributing humanities scholar to Prairie Public. His Plains Folk commentaries explore people, places, and stories that have shaped the Northern Plains. Today's commentary invites us to look beyond familiar legends and consider how history should remember even its most celebrated figures.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 6th. The late 19th century was the golden age of the exposition, often referred to as the World's Fair. Exhibits sponsored by foreign countries and displays of new modern conveniences were viewed with amazement. These events were popular and well attended. It is estimated that more than 20 million people attended the 1893 Chicago World's Fair during its six-month run. Not all Americans were entirely satisfied with the Chicago event. The western portion of the country felt slighted. Westerners thought the fair focused too heavily on the eastern part of the nation. Much of the West was still in territorial status and felt neglected. In 1895, Western states and Western territories, hoping for statehood, banded together to form the Trans-Mississippi West Commercial Congress. The purpose of the new organization was to promote the states and territories west of the Mississippi. It was made up of commercial and industrial representatives, as well as elected representatives from every state and territory west of the Mississippi. One of the first orders of business was organizing an exposition that highlighted the American West. The event was billed as one that would rival Chicago's White City. The Trans-Mississippi and International Exposition was held in Omaha, Nebraska in 1898. And while not as enormous as the Chicago Fair, it attracted more than 2 million visitors and featured more than 4,000 displays in 100 buildings. The success of the fair prompted the organization to continue. On this date in 1905, the Fargo Forum and Daily Republican reported on the upcoming annual meeting of the Congress. It was scheduled to meet in Portland, Oregon, in August. Small committees would meet and bring recommendations to the full body for a vote. The report on the 1905 session included subjects of vast interest to the western states, such as irrigation, rivers, road improvement, and mining. After a vote on each measure, the body named a committee to travel to Washington, D.C. and present the recommendations to Congress. According to the newspaper, this process would be a simple, businesslike way of keeping the commercial interests of the Trans-Mississippi West region in direct touch with the national government. In 1912, Arizona became the last member of the Commercial Congress to be admitted as a state, and Westerners felt fully represented at the national level. The organization disbanded in 1916. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
The FIFA World Cup continues, and there's been a lot happening off the pitch. President Trump disagreed with a red card call on a U.S. player.
I said, I think this should be reviewed because I watched the play.
Now other teams are up in arms saying FIFA caved in to the president. We'll explore the controversy and the results of the USA-Belgium game on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Monday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, it's an interview from Prairie Pulse that airs on the television service of Prairie Public with North Dakota Farmers Union President Matt Perdue. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.
partly to mostly cloudy tonight with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly south. Lows in the mid-50s to mid-60s. Mostly cloudy tomorrow. Showers and thunderstorms likely once again. Highs from the lower 70s northwest to the lower 80s southeast. And your Wednesday, partly cloudy, a slight chance of showers. Lows in the lower 50s to lower 60s and highs mainly in the 70s. That's your weather from member-supported Prairie Public. Coming up next hour, All Things Considered.